Log Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the one and only Scarycast, now live on WLSC AM and FM midnight, and we've got the witching hour, and we're going to have a great time now with all the listeners on WLSC AM and FM. I am so pleased to invite and have our great panels. First of all, from Ravenel, South Carolina, the man that put Battleground Wrestling on the map, one and only Amazing Velvet. How are you doing tonight, Amazing Velvet?
I'm hanging in there. I'm doing good.
Well, we're glad you're there. And from Hollywood, California, our man in Hollywood, Devin Tate. How are you doing?
Howdy, Dr. John. I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm happy to be on the radio with you all tonight.
We are glad to have you here. And even though he's displaced and he's out having a great time with some of his family in other parts of the country, the one and only, the Surgeon General of Scarycast, Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, Dodd, I'm doing great. I'm broadcasting from a remote location in Alabama tonight. Yesterday, I was in Tennessee, so we'll be back in South Carolina. But I'm very happy to know that we are going to be broadcasted locally in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. That's WLSC. Is that the correct
station? That is it. WLSC AM and FM. And the owner is Banana Jack Murphy. He's a great guy, and he was excited when we wanted to bring Scarycast to the one and only WLSC. So we're glad to be there, and it's just a lot of fun. So all I've got to say is thanks to everybody for being here. Robin should be here shortly, and it's just gonna be great. So it was really interesting. We had an experimental podcast last night called the Vulnerability Podcast. And let me tell you guys about this. It's really interesting. People finally agree that they can talk honestly with folks about their vulnerabilities and they can become friends. This group on Facebook, now by the way, Matt Perry, who has started this group, is going to be our guest next week, and on Scarycast. But I'll tell you what, he's a firm believer that the more friends we have, the better off we are. And I think it's just great. I've met a lot of really cool people, and I just think it's going to be a wonderful thing. I can't wait to have him on here talking about how we can just all communicate and how we can really be friends with each other. And that's what the whole Vulnerability Podcast is about. I mean, have you ever heard of anything like this?
No.
I haven't. I think in order to be
openly vulnerable, that would make you instantly a very brave person. Most people want to hide their vulnerabilities. They don't want to expose them. But I think, like all sorts of things in the world, when you expose yourself to risk, sometimes there's wonderful opportunity. And if you have a caring and sharing group, then you probably will come out way ahead of the game. I expect that's what he's discovered.
I think that's exactly what he's discovered, and it's really wonderful. They've got almost 1,000 members in no more than 2 months. So,
that's really good.
And I think it's just great. And so, you know, what do we do? We need to support that, and I think it's going to be a great thing to do. Starting next week, we're going to add him at least to our show. And we're going to talk to him about the thing. So now, Amazing Velvet. So tell us about some of the great things that you've been doing. Jen Cruz is going to be joining us in a couple of minutes, so give me an opportunity to get her on our podcast and our radio show. So, Amazing Velvet, take away for about a minute and help me out here.
Okay. right. Well, on our end, I host pro wrestling interviews every Sunday night on Blog Talk Radio. It's also going to be shared on the radio in Myrtle Beach as well. If you can't find the call letters, you can always go to tigerradio.com. That's where they post all their stuff. That's his, that guy's actual website. You can get to the AM and FM channels from that and the sponsors and all that. It's pretty cool. It's a low-key radio station, which is perfect for us, but it might help him grow in the long run. And I think that's going to be something that we can all look forward to. I think ScaryCast will be as good for them as he'll be for us as a whole, as far as ScaryCast is concerned, and then pro wrestling interviews is concerned. Being on that radio station, an FM station is always good to be on. So hopefully,
well, Velvet, I understand. This is Trey. I understand that you've got some exciting developments. You and Dr. John are working on Hall of Fame wrestling organization for South Carolina, and it will be in Myrtle Beach. Tell us about that.
We're gonna do one in Myrtle Beach, and we're gonna do one. The first one's gonna be in North Charleston, South Carolina. It's called the Carolina Wrestling Hall of Fame. We have NWA Hall of Famer Susan Green going in. Of course, Papa Stro, who always graces our presence on a lot of podcasts, including this one from time to time. He was in WCW, Smoky Mountain Wrestling. He was in a lot of different television organizations. Myself, I'm going in. L.A. Tank from ECW is going in. Crazy Train was in WCW and WWE. His real name is John Bullock, but everybody calls him Crazy Train. I love it. and Tony Rose. Tony Rose is a midget that was trained by the fabulous Moolah. And now that Moolah and Mae Young are gone, she's the last of a generation with Susan. So it's only right to put her in while she's still around. And she was a great, great female midget wrestler. So, yeah, and then we're going to do one in Myrtle Beach. I don't know the exact date for that one, but this one is going to be May 15th at Holy City Brewing Company in North Charleston, South Carolina. So, yeah, it's going to be really exciting. We put posters out. I have put posters out all over North Charleston. And I posted it on all my social media, and in 2 days I already have 400 hits. So I'm hoping to get more. We're looking for it's going to be a big event. So, yes.
What is going to be at the event? Is it going to be live wrestling, or is it going to be?
No. This is just the Hall of Fame.
I see.
Go ahead. Yeah, it's just going to be a Hall of Fame. We Battleground Championship Wrestling will be doing a show there sometime in the near future. Don't know when yet. Things are opening up slowly here, and they're getting more relaxed. So as that happens and the brewery gets a little more comfortable with the patrons, then they'll give me a date. We'll have a show at that place as well. But this first thing is just a Hall of Fame induction. It's like basically a fan fest for people to come out and see the people going into the Hall of Fame and meet and greet,
well, I've got
pictures
to admit,
and all that fun stuff.
I know next to nothing about professional wrestling, but it sounds like you've got quite a crew in South Carolina that has contributed nationally to this sport.
Oh, absolutely. There's so many more in the state that people don't even know who they are, or if they do, they see them on TV for, you know, and they're like, you know, they don't know he's actually from South Carolina, he or she. So there's plenty of ladies and gentlemen that are in the business that actually came from South Carolina that a lot of people just don't – either they don't know they're from there or they just don't recognize them. So, yeah, there's a lot that has contributed to the sport all over the world from South Carolina. It's amazing. So, yeah, it's going to be fun. We have an amazing crew here. So, yes, you're right.
Well, we really do. And speaking of an amazing crew, first of all, our co-host, she's back here with us, the one and only Robin McCray. How are you doing, Robin?
Yay,
I'm
Robin.
Good. How is everybody tonight?
Hey, Robin.
Good, Robin.
ScaryCast. We're so glad to have you here.
Thanks. Had a little trouble getting on tonight. Sorry.
But that's okay. Yep. And I'll tell you what, we now have our featured guest, one of the most amazing people I've ever met. She's the leader of the She Squashers. And Jen Cruz, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, guys. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Jen, how are you?
I'm good.
We're
hey,
so
I,
glad
I,
to
I'm
have
gonna
you.
Be seeing... Yeah, I'm excited to be back on Scary Cat.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We're glad to have you here. And first of all, because you're the head of a group of ladies, now is it, can I call you ladies or girls or what do we call it?
Sure.
Well, whatever you want, John. Those are nice terms.
Okay. We'll call you ladies. And so we're glad that you are here. And you go out and you do Bigfoot exploration. You've had some amazing things that have happened to you. The cover of one of my books has to do with the fact that you stopped the car and said, stop, there's something going on. Do you mind telling that? So this is a night of stories with Jen Cruz. So do you mind telling us that great story about how you got the picture of all those Bigfoot artifacts?
Yes. What happened was on the very first time we went out, because I'm an energy healer by trade, I feel energy on a physical level. And when I was looking for Bigfoot, I was trying to hone in on that energy frequency, whatever that was, because I hadn't felt it before. And I felt an energy that I had never felt before, and that's where we actually had our first encounter. So then I was so familiar with this energy that is of Bigfoot. And so when we were out on a different scouting mission in a different location, we were driving from one location to the next, and I was in the passenger seat and another one of the teammates was driving. That way I felt like I could have my psychic awareness fully open. I don't like to drive like that. I don't think it's safe. It's like driving with one eye in this world and one eye in the other world. You know, it's just not a safe thing to do. So a teammate was driving and we were going like 55 miles an hour down this road. And all of a sudden I felt that energy pull me to the right. And I was like, stop the car.
Stop the
There's
car.
There's something back there in that woods back there. Let's go back, see if we can get in that woods over there. And so we turned around, and only because we were on my Indian reservation in Minnesota are we allowed just to go anywhere we want. You know, otherwise you kind of have to stop and see who owns this land. Do we have permission to be on this land? On this reservation, I don't need that because the land is held in trust by all tribal members. So I don't necessarily have to stop and say who owns this. I know who owns it. It's tribal land. So we turned around and we found a spot where we could drive into the trees that we had just passed. And there was like a little woods there. And behind that little woods was a gravel pit. And clear as day, you could see going up this side of this gravel pit hill. It's very steep. You could see these footprints going all the way to the top. And they were massive footprints. And it was such a steep hill that two of my teammates tried to climb it next to these footprints, and they were on their hands and feet, and they would take a step and they would slide back down halfway down of what they stepped, and because it was that steep. And there's no way they could have just taken their feet and climbed up this hill just with their feet. But this that made the tracks we were looking at never put its hands down. And when I showed all this, the pictures and the video and everything to Bobo from the TV show Finding Bigfoot, I was at an event where he was, and I showed all this to him, and he said, "Whoa, that's a steep hill." And I said, "Yeah, it sure was." And he said, "A bear could not have done that like that, and that a human could not have done that. That had to be a Squatch. There's no other explanation for that. It had to be a Squatch." And that's what we felt, too. And I think that one of the pictures that we took of those footprints ended up on the cover of one of your books, John.
Well, it did. And I think it's very important because it is just pictures of tracks going straight up a hill. Now, Robin you have obviously been involved in a lot of things like this, and so could you make some comments about this?
Well, yeah. I mean, to begin with, when you see something that's at an incline like that, you obviously, you might as well remove our humans out of the equation. It's not going to happen. It just isn't. Mm-hmm. And then you see this prolonged pattern of them, and you know. Now, I will say there's all kinds of cryptids out there. Most of your cryptids are a human hybrid cross, like Dogman would be human, ET, and canine. You know, we now know that with the Bigfoots, it's a human cross. So it's like if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, it's a duck. You know what I mean? And you see these tracks that go in these impossible places. And I've seen this before in various places that I've been. And it's like you look at it and, you know, like when you look at it, you know that's what it is. But then your mind goes to try to rationalize it, you know, and say, okay, really, though, what is it? But there's nothing else it can be. And then when you look at the stride length is also really telling. You know, we may have a 3-foot stride, but there's just like 5. And in some cases, depending on the size of the individual, it's bigger. And I know, you know, like when Igor's been at my house before, we were going down this dirt road and we were walking, and we found a huge trackway of 2 different individuals. And he is a very tall man, but he could not stretch his legs out long enough to do that stride. You know, so when not only are you looking at an incline, but when you see the footprint, it's the stride length. It's the way it's done. We cannot duplicate what they do. We just can't.
And I think that's a wonderful statement. When you look at the ground, what kind of you said it was a gravel pit. Well, gravel wouldn't leave. You couldn't see much of a footprint in gravel. So was this a dirt, mud? What type of a substance was the base of the track?
It actually was gravel. It was like a sandy gravel.
Because of their weight, if I can just say one thing, and then, Jen, go back to you. But because of their weight, you can get a really good trackway in gravel. Because when they walk, they do this heel-to-toe ratio more so than we do. And so it grinds that heel down in deep, and then you've got your arch, and then you've got your toes. And because of their massive weight and the length of the stride, the toes tend to dig in.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime I've seen tracks on gravel or at a gravel pit, you actually can get, believe it or not, where when we walk across a gravel pit, you can't tell we've ever been there.
Right.
They do it completely different. You would be amazed.
And also at a high grade, you would expect the toes to dig in just to grasp so they can shove, so they could locomote effectively. It would have to be heel to toe, grabbing in with toes and then pulling yourself forward. So I could see what you mean.
Jen, I have a question for you. On those tracks, by any chance, did you notice knuckle prints? And the reason I say that is where I've seen I've seen individuals go up a steep incline and not even, you know, use their hands as well. But I've also seen it where, depending on how steep it is, you'll find knuckle prints because they are going up bipedal, but they'll lean forward and they'll grab, you know, with their hands and push off.
That was really the thing that was really amazing to us because the girl climbed up next to them, and there were no knuckle prints at all. It was strictly feet.
And
you could see the 5 toes. You could see all that. And we measured each one. Each footprint was measured. And some of them you could tell that the foot was sliding a little bit. So, like, the biggest one was, like, 24 inches, but it was sliding. And then the smallest print was 18 inches, and it didn't appear to have slid.
Oh, that's great.
And,
so 18 inches, you're looking at roughly 9.5, 10 foot.
Yeah. And they were deep in there, too. They were deep. So we tried to cast. We tried making 2 casts right up the middle of the hill. We chose the ones that we thought were the best. And it was honestly our first time trying to cast a footprint. And when we found this, it was getting towards evening, and we didn't have the casting material right there with us, enough of it anyway. And so we decided we really want to document this better, and we don't want to ruin anything because we're losing light fast. So we decided to come back the next day. And I was up there working a contract for the reservation. I was doing a conference for them. I do sometimes work with the American Indian Sexual Assault Advocate Coalition in Minnesota. And so I was doing a conference with that at the reservation. So I was working during the day. And my teammates were supposed to go out there and cast him. And I gave them a phone number of another Bigfoot researcher from the reservation over. And he had offered to help whenever we needed help, and he was really good at casting. And I said, call this guy, have him come out. He will come out and help cast these so that they're good. You know, we want good casts. Well, they didn't really do that. They're like, oh, well, we'll wait for Jen. And I'm like, don't wait for me. Do it right away because I have to work all day. And they just felt that I would want to be involved. And, you know, I thought I was really clear about how I didn't care about being involved in the casting. I just wanted it to be done right and quickly. But they waited for me to get off work, and they didn't call the guy. So we ended up doing it ourselves, and it did not turn out. It did not turn out at all. But we've talked to other Bigfoot researchers since then, and they've given us some pointers on what to do next time for casting in a gravel pit. They suggested using a really starchy hairspray, let it set up, and then put some saran wrap into it before you pour it in. Because what happened when we poured our casting material in there is it grabbed all that gravel and all that sand, and it just became a big mess of something that didn't even look like a footprint anymore.
Right.
So that was sad. But at least we got the pictures and the measurements.
Jen, you mentioned, this is Trey, you mentioned this was one of the first times you went hunting. Is that correct?
This was the first time we had footprints to cast. We had found footprints before, but they weren't castable. They were the footprints we'd found before were not castable. They were too shallow. You could see them, but they weren't something that you could cast.
Well, you said you're an energy healer by trade. How did you run across the, I don't know what we call it, the energy signature of Squatch, or the frequency of that energy? How did you first encounter that frequency to know to look for that?
Well, everything has an energy frequency. Everything, every
right.
living thing has an energy frequency. So when I
right.
first started looking, the very first time we went out looking, I was asking and having my awareness open to feel energies of, and I felt an energy that I had not felt before in a specific location. We got out of the car. We looked around. We didn't see anything that would lead us to believe that Bigfoot was there. But I marked those GPS coordinates and kept them because I said, I want to come back to this spot tonight because there's an energy here I've never felt before. And I was asking to locate Bigfoot. So I was asking like my intuition, my guide, to help me locate the energy of Bigfoot. We did go back to that spot that night, and that is where we had our first encounter. When we first parked the car, we were at this place called 6 Mile Lake in Minnesota. It's on a reservation. It's a long, skinny lake. And so on one side of the lake, you've got cabins and houses with docks. And on the other side of the lake, you've got nothing but thick woods and a little road that the trees come up right up to the road. And only one car can drive at a time on this road. So if you meet somebody head on, one of you is going to have to back up because you can't cross paths there. And so that's called Reservation Highway 20, which I think is really deceiving because it's a one-car road. So
sounds
we get
like
out
driving
there at
in
night.
Scotland.
Is that really? I've never been to Scotland.
They're basically one way, and they build the road so you can see all the way down to a pullout, and whoever and one of you will, you both people go in an opposite directions will see each other, and then one of you goes into a pullout, allow the other person to pass, and then you get back, and it's just, I mean, it's just the way it works. So that's what it reminds me of, Scotland driving.
So we were out there, and we, this was on the side of the lake where there were no homes and there were no people. It was just thick forest and this little road that goes through it. And there had been a sighting of Bigfoot on this lake a few weeks prior to that. And a native man had been out fishing in his canoe, which he launched from what they said was a public boat launch. And the only public boat launch that was listed on this lake was on the side of all the cabins. And I said right off the bat, I don't think Bigfoot would be over there. If I was Bigfoot, I'd be over here where there's no people. And we found out, you know, probably weeks later that there is another boat launch that only the local people know about. It's the site of an old homestead that the home was torn down like decades ago. And they still have the little spot where they can launch a boat. And so the locals will leave their canoes down there and they'll go launch their canoes from there. So this gentleman had been fishing in his canoe and it was starting to get dark. So he decided he was done and he was going to go in. And as he was reaching the shoreline where this little boat launch is, there was a Bigfoot in the shallows, like up to his knees. And he was aggressively moving along the shoreline with matching this canoe. And, you know, the gentleman was, you know, a little scared. He didn't quite know what to do. And he described the Bigfoot as being, like, blondish gray, white hair. And so he decided to just keep going down the shoreline, and it followed him wherever he went. But it didn't get any deeper in the water. So he was out in his canoe for 2 hours waiting for this thing to go away. And it was pitch dark by that time. And so finally one of his family members had realized that he never came home and he should have been home. They thought maybe something had happened to him, so they drove out there. And they started, you know, flicking their lights and honking the horn. And the Bigfoot turned and ran into the woods. And he watched where he went in. So he went in, landed the canoe, and they left. And the next day they came back out there, and they went to look to see if there were any footprints where it had gone back into the woods. And sure enough, there were lots of footprints because it was very, very muddy. And so they got lots of casts out of that. And the gentleman who I had wanted to call to come and help cast those was the one who casted them. That reservation actually funds his research and buys his equipment and everything. They fund his Bigfoot research, which I think is super cool. And, you know, he's always willing to help out if you want help with something. So, this was, you know, the side of the lake where there weren't any people on him. We didn't find that out until weeks later. But the spot that I had identified with that different energy, when we went back there that night, it was so dark that we couldn't see anything. There was no ambient light whatsoever. It was just pitch dark. And thick trees, you know, thick trees, no moon, just really dark. And so we parked on the road because there's nowhere to pull off. And I had my stuff ready to go in my hand, and everybody else had their equipment in the back of the truck. So one of the girls handed me a thermal camera that she had borrowed from somebody that she knew on a paranormal investigations team. And I was so excited because I had never gotten to play with a thermal camera before. So I took the thermal camera, and I'm now scanning the woods with it because I don't know how long she's going to let me hold it. And all I knew was that if you pulled the trigger, it would take a picture. And so I'm really excited to see if I could see anything out there, any bunnies or deer or anything. And so I'm looking through it, and I'm scanning the woods, and I'm scanning, and I get out where I'm pointing it out in front of the car, and there's somebody standing there. And, you know, it's very clearly a human shape. And so I just assumed it was one of the girls. And I said, hey, who's out in front of the car? Nobody answered. And I said, hey, who's in front of the car? Nobody answered. And so I kept asking that, but there was more anxiety in my voice as I continued to ask. And all of a sudden, Marlo, she realized there was something going on with me. So she comes running up to see what's going on. I'm at the front of the car. And she looks at the screen that I'm looking at this human shape giving off of heat signature in front of the car off to the left. And she sees what I'm seeing, and she looks up to look at it to see if she can see anything there with her eyes. And she says, oh, my gosh, I just saw red eyes. And I said, mm-hmm. You did? And so I looked up from the screen to see if I could see any eyes, and I didn't see any. And then when I looked back down, I couldn't find it again. I'd lost it. And I kept scanning for it, so it just must have stepped into the woods there because it was on the left side of the road where it was just outside of the wood line. And it just must have stepped back in and was hidden after that. So we decided, okay, that wasn't any of us because we were all accounted for at that time. So it wasn't that night, and it wasn't the next night. It wasn't the next week or even months later. It was when we got another thermal camera that I really had the opportunity to play with for a long time that I realized that everybody looks really different when they have clothes on. Your heat signature looks different when you have clothes on. And I was like, you know, what I saw that night wasn't wearing clothes. It was giving the same heat signature throughout the whole body. It didn't have a lower temperature for where the clothes were covering. So there were no clothes. And I asked Marlo, you know, when you saw the screen, did you see clothes? And she said, no, I didn't. You're right. So that was like something that we realized much, much later. But it was a good realization to have, I guess, that it actually wasn't wearing clothes. And so that was even better. So back to that night, we were we decided, okay, we're going to walk into the woods towards the left where it must have disappeared to. And so a few of us started to walk into the woods that way. And we didn't get very far at all before we started hearing some movement. And we stopped because we're hearing something coming through the branches of the trees. And all of a sudden, this thing falls on the ground and bounces about 3 feet in front of us. And I look at it, and I said, is that a rock? And Marlo said, I think that is a rock. And then we hear something else coming through the branches of the trees, and then another one bounces right next to it, and then another one, and another one. And I got to tell you, I didn't know a lot about Bigfoot at that point in time in my life, and I did not know that they were known for throwing rocks at people. And so I was just dumbfounded standing there going, what the heck? What's throwing rocks at us in this forest at night? That doesn't make any sense. I've grown up in the forests of Minnesota, which is where we were. Nothing has ever thrown rocks at me before. There's nothing in here that would throw rocks. You know, what's the deal? And so I kind of opened my awareness to see, well, what does this mean? And I felt like it's telling us not to walk this way. So we decided, okay, we're going to back up. So we backed back up to the road. And then we're kind of just standing there trying to figure out what to do now. And because we want to be respectful to the Bigfoot. If obviously you're walking into somebody's territory. You know, you don't just walk into some stranger's home and make yourself comfortable. You know, if don't walk this way means don't walk this way, right? So
by the way, Jen, I want to say this. Robin McRae tells me this all the time, this exact same thing about you don't walk into someone's living room. Right, Robin?
Robin?
Yeah, when we had Robin on the show.
Sorry, guys.
It's a lot of parallels, exactly parallels with what she's described, too.
Exactly.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. I was trying to talk and nobody could hear me.
Oh, we can hear you now. You're perfect.
Yeah, I could hear everybody, but I couldn't get anybody to hear me. Now, John, what did you ask me?
So what I said
was... Oh, I
was
just saying, are you there?
Jen was talking about how people, Jen, could you help me re-describe it? I'm having one of those moments.
Okay, you
have to be respectful when you're in their territory. You just don't clock yourself down in somebody else's living room.
Exactly.
Yeah, I do, and that's a comparison I always use because, I mean, how would you feel if you're sitting there with your family watching TV, relaxing, and a stranger walks into your house?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people get so upset when the Bigfoot get upset, but when you walk out your front door, you're now in their world. You're in their home. You know, they understand and respect territories between clans, but our sense of territories in homes make no sense to them, none at all. And they don't understand it.
That makes sense to me. So when we decided to back to the road and not go any further, then one of the girls said, "Hey, why don't we do one of those Bigfoot calls like they do on TV?" I said, "Okay, go for it."
Oh my God!
So she did a whoop. She did a whoop. This was our first time out. This was our first time. And our first time out at night. So she did a whoop, and we were all very quiet, waiting to hear if anything responded. And we didn't get any whoops back, but all of a sudden something started to walk towards us.
Uh-oh.
And you can hear it taking each step, and it would, like, crack on some stick. Big sticks were cracking, and you could tell it was bipedal. It was 1 foot after the other, 2 feet coming, and it sounded big.
So
I mean,
I
don't think I could make
you.
Yeah.
And this is just me being nosy, I guess. You were talking about,
yeah,
you know, they were throwing rocks and things at you, isn't it? Everything keeps breaking out. I'm having major problems with the phone issue tonight, but... If I remember, you were saying something about they're tossing rocks at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. If we could go back to that for just a second, if you wouldn't mind. I just have a couple of questions about it. Now, because it means different things, that's the only reason I asked. When they were throwing the rocks at you, were you getting like little light pebbles that were being tossed at you, or were you getting a bigger rock that was actually being forcibly thrown at you? Because it means two different things.
They were little rocks, maybe the size of a 50-cent piece to a silver dollar, and it was like they were being underhand thrown up through the branches of the trees and then coming down.
That means something completely different. And I just, for our listeners, I wanted to separate that because I get a lot of calls from people that say, "I just had this encounter," and of course, I'm not referring to you, Jen, at all, because I know you know what you're doing. But, you know, for people out there that have not had that encounter yet or might start to have an encounter, I just wanted to clarify that. When you get like what Jen had, that is nothing more than them letting you know they're there. That's not aggression. It's not trying to run them out of the territory. That is simply like if you were outside and your neighbor's over in their yard and they're waving hi. The only thing is when they do it like that, it's a protection thing for them because they want to see, are you a threat? They want you to know they're there, but they also want to see, are you a threat? If they do that and you're not turning around and shooting fire at, you know, guns and firearms at them, then you're okay. They know they're safe. And then they can proceed and they can walk alongside. They can get a little bit closer and you get a little bit more interaction. But I get people that contact me a lot and some of them are like, they threw these rocks at me. And I'm like, okay, first of all, let's go to what size rock are we talking? Because, and Jen, I know you know this, if they want you out of there and they're going to throw a rock at you in aggression, they do not miss, and they use the big stuff. But
I know
not
people
uncommon.
Who've had big rocks. I know people have had big rocks just barely miss their head. Like,
if they wanted to hit them, they would have been hit.
Yeah.
But what you were getting, just so that for people that don't know and that are listening to the show, just to clarify for them, because, Jen, you probably already knew, but that's the reason why I brought it up, is what was being done with you was not aggression. That was simply, we're here, we're around, you know, we're not trying to hurt anybody, but we're here.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between a toss of a small rock versus the active throwing of a projectile.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, Trey, you would be amazed the amount of people that will literally get so terrified at that type of an encounter that they claim they have PTSD. I'm not even kidding you. And I respect that. Everybody reacts differently because it's all unknown. They don't even know what it is. You know, they just know these things are going on. So I respect that 110%, and they're entitled to their feelings. Absolutely. But that was another reason why I just wanted to put that out there, because I knew Jen knew it, but for the people out there listening that thought, oh, wow, she went out there and they were really trying to hurt her. What happened with that was not someone trying to hurt her. That was
I didn't
simply
feel
saying, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I wasn't doing it for Jen's, saying it for Jen's benefit as much as for anybody that's listening.
Yeah. I was really impressed with their ability to aim, because the rocks were landing right next to each other and they never came within 3 feet of us. I mean, it was like between 3 and 4 feet of us. That was it, you know, and I was impressed.
I mean, they're amazing when
it
comes to
that. Trying to hit me. Yeah. It was obvious they weren't trying to hit us with those.
No, not at all.
So I didn't feel like that was dangerous. So when something started to walk towards us, it didn't come from that side of the road. It came from the other side of the road. So
there's definitely more than one there.
Yes. And it was walking towards us. And the girls that I had with me that night were all from a paranormal investigation team. And so I brought them with. This was our first time trying it. I brought them with because I thought, well, all these girls already have night vision cameras for ghost hunting. We already have equipment. Let's go out there and give this a try, because it was Lauren Coleman's who gave me the idea to go and out and try this. So we were just going to go out and try it. And when we started hearing this something walking towards us very loudly, all of us pointed our cameras at it, and none of us could see anything. And because we learned that, you know, these cameras that we had for paranormal investigating in haunted houses light up the haunted houses really well in the inside, but they don't really penetrate the dark woods very well at all. So we couldn't see anything.
Well, years ago, I had some researchers that had come to my house, and, you know, they were really good friends of mine, but the one had brought a friend of his, and he had all these night vision goggles, and we thought, oh, this is going to be so much fun. You know, so we looked through them a little bit, and we had a couple places there was some eye shine, and you could see a little bit of an outline. And he had them, and we're walking around, you know, and we're thinking, okay, we'll see what we can find. And he has these night vision glasses on, and he goes to turn around. And, of course, at the time, they were, like, in that mode where they're not in complete physical form, but they're not 100% cloaked. And he went to turn around, and he was really only about 5 feet from the woods, and the whole woods was lit up. And he saw these night vision. And I tell you what, it scared the living daylights out of that poor man. I felt so bad for him. He's like, I don't know if I'm coming back or not.
Oh, no.
It was cool, though, because this had the ability to take the pictures, too. So he was able to get some really good pictures.
Nice.
But he was, like, not planning to see what he saw. You know, I mean, he wasn't getting a whole lot of anything. And when he did get them, it was like, you could see the outline of them, and you could see the eyes, and you could see a little bit of the movement. But he was looking one way, and he went to go stop and turn around, and they were, like, right there.
Oh, wow. That'd be fun.
When you had that encounter where they were tossing rocks to let you know we're there, and that was the distraction so they could come up from behind, that makes tactical sense to me. But did you feel the energy that you had been looking for? Was that present for you? At that point, were you out of your psychic receiving mode because you were trying to figure out where these rocks are coming from?
Well, every time I was tuning into feeling energy, I felt that energy, that unique energy frequency that was new to me. But I was really trying to clear my senses, to keep my senses open, because I'm now surrounded by my friends who were scared to death.
Sure.
And especially when something was walking towards us and we couldn't see what it was, and we're all looking and we can't see. And then all of a sudden, it was almost like somebody flipped a switch, and that sound of something walking towards us multiplied, and now there was something walking towards us from multiple directions. We were surrounded. And we never talked about what to do, what we were going to do if we got in trouble or if we felt like we were in trouble, but automatically we just circled up back to back facing out, and we're all looking to see if we can see what's coming, and none of us could see anything. And you know, they were really scared. I'm like, stop being afraid and just let me feel this. And you know, I still didn't feel like we were in danger. And so one of the girls said, Jen, do your tobacco thing. Quick, do your tobacco thing. And we were on an Indian reservation, and I am part Ojibwe. And so I took the tobacco. What she meant was do a prayer, a native prayer. So I took the tobacco in my hand, and I started to speak out loud in Ojibwe. And I introduced myself with all of my spirit names and where I come from and my clan and who named me and my, you know, family members. And then I started to say, Miigwech Meimeigweishik, which is thank you to the little people of the forest. And then I said, Miigwech Kichisabe, which is thank you to Bigfoot. As soon as I said, thank you to Bigfoot, everything stopped. All the noise that was coming at us from all these different directions just stopped. It didn't retreat. It didn't come forward. It just stopped, and everything went silent.
That's fantastic.
And I was excited because I had been told by elders from different reservations that you can pray to Bigfoot to help you with this or to keep the deer off the road, and they will do that for you. And you can, you know, you give tobacco and you pray to them, and you ask them for something, and they will help you. And so, you know, I'd never, of course, tried this before. So when I said thank you, Bigfoot, in the Ojibwe language, and they stopped, I was like, yeah, that's so cool. And
so Jen, that is an amazing thing to say. So that works.
It worked.
Well,
it
you know,
worked.
Rob,
I was
you
like,
know,
they were right.
After listening to Robin and her fantastic stories about her encounters with Bigfoot and multiple Bigfoots, you said that they're practical jokers. So I could see a bunch of them circling you and then walking in as a practical joke. But when you address them seriously with respect and you spoke in a language they could understand, when they stopped, they probably all looked at each other and said, hey, this is for real. This person knows what they're doing. And that would open up a whole new relationship for you. I'm sure it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And the girls that I was with, they don't speak Ojibwe. They had no idea what I had just said. And they didn't know that the silence came as a result of saying, thank you, Bigfoot. And they were just terrified. And they're like, all right, well, hey, why don't we go over to that spot we found footprints earlier today? And I said, okay. So we jumped in the car and we drove away.
They were probably worried that you'd say the shortest one is the slowest, so we're going to run and you can go after the slow one. They didn't know what you said in Ojibwe.
Right? Take this one. She's tastier.
Yeah, she's slow.
I have a question, Joan.
Is that the Amazing Velvet? Yes, you have a question?
Yes, I do. I missed on the gravel part. What part of Minnesota was that in?
We were on the Red Lake
gravel pit.
We were on the Red Lake Indian Reservation.
And whereabouts is that in the state of Minnesota, actually? Is it northern Minnesota or?
It is. Yeah, it's northern Minnesota. It's the largest body of fresh water completely contained in the United States.
Cool. Because I'm a huge fan of Minnesota. I've been there only twice in my life, but I'm a huge fan of Minnesota. Especially the sports. But anyway, that's a side note. I've heard other stories, though, that they sometimes cross into the Dakotas during certain times of the years and come back, or if they're like tribal themselves, maybe they stay. But I've heard they have migrated like to Canada and to the Dakotas. Have you had any feeling of that? Have they traveled? Have they just been there the whole time?
Some of them do travel. I don't think all of them do because, you know, even this winter, people were finding footprints in the snow up there, in like the cedar bogs. They were finding footprints out in the cedar bogs with like a 5-foot stride.
They don't do a regular migration. People keep saying that, and it's not a regular migration. It's kind of like, you know, we have certain people that don't want to be there in the wintertime, and so they'll go south. I had an adult male, and his mate, he would stay in Michigan in the wintertime, and she would go down to Florida. I mean, she did. He didn't like the cold. She wasn't thrilled with being there. And then, like in Michigan, everybody would say they would leave, and I still had activity all winter long. You know, they go in underground tunnels, and they have caves in the underground, and, you know, they'll get in these abandoned farmhouses and stuff like that. And they had them going in and out of Detroit, Michigan in the dead of winter. You know, they're like sometimes in Colorado, I've heard, you know, different people that live there have said they'll follow the elk herds. But it's not like a regular migration. Like for me, when I hear migration, you know, I think like, you know, geese migrate. You know, they go south for the winter and that kind of thing. But it's not, I don't think it's a real migration.
I probably used the wrong word. What I meant was they, you know, to travel to different parts. Maybe they have different parts of family for themselves.
I think some do, but I think it's individualized.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, Jen, what do you think?
What
is your thoughts, Jen? Because my experiences have been, it's an individualized thing. I mean, there's some that will tolerate the cold and there's others that won't.
And somebody the other day who claims that they have Bigfoot by their home out in the country, and they live on the river with lots of woods there. And I believe that they're there because I've had lots of reports of Bigfoot being out there in that general area anyway. But this person thinks that they go somewhere else in the wintertime. And he said where he thinks that they go. And I could see that they would go that way. But if I was them between the two locations, I would have ended up in a valley, in a wooded valley with water. In Minnesota, it gets really cold here in the wintertime. It gets really cold. And if you're down in the valley, which I grew up on a farm down in the valley, it's not very cold down there. If the wind is whipping and there's a blizzard, you don't even know it down in the valley. It's just a nice day.
Oh, wow.
Because the wind is blowing right over the top of you. You're down in the valley. So,
yeah.
I mean, lots of times I was walking home because I'd get dropped off on the highway and I'd have to walk in because we had such a long drive with it, and then it went down into the valley that the school bus could never have gotten out of there in the wintertime. So I had to walk 3/4 of a mile to get back down to home. And I'd be walking up there on the area where the driveway is, which is really long and up where the fields are, and then it curves and goes down, and our driveway right by the house was a sledding hill. I would slide down it on a sled. And so I'd get home and I'd be so mad at my mom because she let me walk that, and it was like a whiteout up there. I'm like, Mom, I had to walk that way. I got lost. Couldn't see where I was going. And she's like, well, I didn't even know it was storming. It didn't look like it was storming down there. And so if I was Bigfoot in the wintertime, I would definitely move down into the valley where it's nice. It's warmer. The wind isn't whipping and cutting at you. It's definitely a lot warmer down there.
It can get -30 in Minnesota.
Sometimes -50. It can happen.
I know. That's crazy. And
I know. And the fact that they don't use fire, I've never seen evidence of them using fire. But I think that they probably do dig down into the earth and dig caves or dens. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way they can really stay warm in Minnesota. Yeah. That's
right.
The only way
they
can really stay warm
in Minnesota.
Two
of my boys live there, but I've never been. They usually they come up this way. But I've heard stories about how just unbelievably cold it gets there.
Yeah.
I would think they would have to use fire. they do know how, and they have. Like, I've seen it happen. I know some clans, and I've used this analysis before, and it kind of works. It's like with the Amish. You have sectors that will have electricity, some that don't, some that use automobiles, some of them that just have horse and buggy. It just depends on that sector, and it tends to be like that with the Bigfoots in certain areas. And there are some sectors that will not use fire because they're afraid they'll be detected, but for the most part, they do know how. They used to come up in my backyard, and we had a bonfire pit, and there was on more than one occasion, and I had family visiting one time. They came up in the back into that bonfire pit, and they had the bonfire pit going. And then we would, every now and then, we would find them, you know, evidence of it out in the woods. But, yeah, they will use it. I mean, they're very selective when they do it or how they do it, but they do it. But I don't think they all do. Like I said, I think it has to do with whatever clan and what the laws of that clan are, whether or not they allow it.
Jen, over time, this first encounter was how many years ago for you?
Oh, boy. 2015?
Oh, wow.
So you've been doing this for 7 years or 6 or 7 years at this point. Has your ability to detect the energy field, I would imagine you're much more sensitive to it. You can detect it easier, smoother, more efficiently. And has that led you to discover anything really interesting that you might share with us?
Well, you know, I also do the what I call geographic remote viewing, where I'm looking at maps, satellite imagery of locations, and asking, is Bigfoot here, or is there any Bigfoot evidence that we could collect here? And then nailing down what I see on the image changes in relation to what I'm asking about. So I used the same technique when I was working with paranormal investigations teams that were going to go research at a certain location because people were asking for help. I would look at this location before they would go there and tell them what was going on. I was very accurate. Very accurate.
So,
and sometimes I would get
tell us how geographic remote viewing works. So if I wanted you to remote view Columbia, South Carolina, how would you go about, what's the process that you would use to do this?
What am I looking for?
So you have to know what you're looking for.
Well, you know, when I would do work with a paranormal investigation team, obviously the place is having some kind of a haunting of some type of paranormal,
right?
Something is happening. So I would look at the location from satellite, and I would ask what's going on here, and I would start to see images of what was, and it's kind of like charades because I'm seeing an image, I'm not necessarily hearing anything. And so I have to figure out, what does that mean? And so I ask questions, is it this, is it that, is it this, is it that? And I'll give you an example of the first time they had me do this for them. They wanted to see if I could do this. And so I said, sure, I'll give it a try. So they gave me GPS coordinates to the location they were going to go look at. See, people were asking for help. They didn't really know what was going on there yet. So I looked at the location. It was a house. And what I saw was a spirit bear looking at itself, not wanting to be here anymore. It was feeling very sad. And so I wrote that down. And then I saw three Indians staring at the bear all the time. And they were right in a row. One of them had feathers, like an Indian chief headdress. And the next one had a wolf pelt on its head. And the one next to that was wearing a bison fur with horns on its head. And all three of those Indians were always staring at the bear. And so I wrote that down. And then I saw a hunter running towards me, and he was screaming, although I couldn't hear what he was saying. He was screaming about something that they never should have done. And he was very adamant. They did something they never should have done. And I was like, okay. And then I saw a human skeleton in the house. I was like, there's a dead body in the house? there's a dead human body in the house? And I got, yes. And I said, you mean a cremation? There's somebody that's cremated, right? No, not cremated. It's a whole body. And I'm like, okay, so somebody is buried in the house? No. I was like, what? Did they kill this person? No, they did not kill this person. Do they know that that person is there? Yes. I'm like, that can't even be true. And here I am arguing, that can't even be true. How can there be a dead human body in the house that they didn't kill? They know it's there. It's not buried. That, and it's not a cremation. That can't even be true. So I asked all those questions multiple times, and it always came back the same. So I wrote it down and went, okay, whatever. And then I saw these weird-looking spirits that I had. They were not human spirits. They were strange spirits that I had never seen before, running through the house, raging mad. They were just ticked off at these people. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that is. And I kept saying, what is that? What is that? And I kept seeing it. It had this weird hair. It looked like weird, wiry hair. And all I could think of looked like some crazy witch with some witchy hair or something, you know, nothing against witches. But I was like, what is that? And I finally realized that those were branches, and they were showing me that they were tree spirits. And I'm like, tree spirits in the house? That doesn't even make sense. But I wrote it down. And so I give this to the guy who was running the paranormal team, and he looked at it and he said, oh boy, I don't know, Jen, maybe you're not good at this. I thought, maybe I'm not. That's what I thought. I don't know what to tell you. I argued with it. I don't think it could be true, but it's what I got, so there it is. And he goes to that place. And he goes to that place, and he calls me, and he said, Jen, you're not going to believe this. I'm like, what?
But,
I'm at the place.
But what is he telling you?
He said, I walk in, and the first thing I see is this giant stuffed black bear, a real black bear. Stuffed, taxidermy, in the corner. And that's the first thing he saw. Well, that's the first thing I saw, a spirit bear looking at itself, too bad that they didn't want to be there anymore. And then he said, across from that, hanging on the wall, are these three Indian masks, the feather headdress, the wolf, the horns. They're all hanging on the wall staring at the bear. And I'm like, yep. Hey, the Indians are staring at the bear. And he said, then he went into the basement, and he said, he was horrified. It's filled with dead animals. The person who lives there was an amateur taxidermist. He was trying to learn how to do taxidermy. And so he was killing all these animals just to practice, and he was doing a horrible job at it. Everything just looked mutilated. And so that was the hunter telling me someday he did something he never should have done. Okay? And then he says, you're not going to believe this. There's a human body in that house, a dead body. I said, shut up. How is that even possible? And he said, they purchased a mummy from a museum that was going out of business because this guy had a thing for taxidermy. He was all about the mummy. So he purchased a mummy from this museum that was going out of business, and they had that in their house. And
that's fantastic.
Like, okay. And then, so get this, they said they'd lived there for many years, they'd never had a problem ever until the day that the tree in the front yard fell down and then all hell broke loose in that house. The tree spirits came in the house.
John, that's amazing. Way to go.
So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I was doing for years before I started doing Bigfoot. So I have a really strong belief in when I see something on a remote view that it's there. That's there. And so when I started to do this with Bigfoot, looking at woods, looking at locations where we think Bigfoot might be, and I start saying, okay, is there Bigfoot here? I'll start to see if there's a Bigfoot there. Or I'll ask, is there Bigfoot evidence we could collect here? And the area would light up this golden color, showing me an area that I should look at. And so I drop a pin on those spots and record the GPS coordinates of where we want to go look for that. And
now,
so
Jen,
that's how we
When you ask, who is it you're directing that question to? Who are you asking? And when you see that, Is it in your mind's eye? Is it a vision that you see in front of yourself? Is it on the map? Does a certain part of the map become more prominent? What is it you're seeing that allows you to then interpret?
I just see an image on the over the map, over the picture of what I'm looking at. If I sometimes mm-hmm. I would, if it was a haunted house, I would have them send me pictures from inside the house. And then mm-hmm. I would, like, if somebody is being haunted really bad and it's messing with the kids, I'm like, put the child down in a room and start taking pictures where I can see the whole room. I want to see the kid in the room. And then I can see what's happening to the kid and what's happening, you know, what's bugging them, what's going on. You know, so I'm just using my mind's eye, using my psychic senses, so to speak, to see what's happening. And when I'm asking my senses, I'm asking my guides, I'm asking those that help me to see these things. And what I see on the picture itself, whatever I'm looking at, changes. And sometimes when I would do this without pictures, I would stay with my eyes closed and I would just see like visions. And one of the very first cases that I worked with somebody that asked me for help, she lived like 4 hours drive away from me, and she was asking me for help. And so it was when I started talking to her, I just closed my eyes and I started to see the inside of her house and what was and I started to see like symbols I didn't recognize carved into different areas in the house. And I started drawing what I was seeing, and I found out that those, I'm not into witchcraft, but I found out that these were witchcraft symbols. I had to do some research to find out what does this mean, you know. Because mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. something I didn't understand when I saw it, but I wrote it down so I could look into it later. And found out that in that particular house, the person that lived there before had been into necromancy. And then I had to have a crash course in what does that mean. And necromancy is somebody who harnesses the power of lost spirits. They capture lost spirits and they hold them in a container, and then they use the power of those lost spirits to fuel their magic spells, because that person doesn't necessarily have any of their own power, natural mm-hmm. power. So they're using the power of these lost spirits and souls. And that particular old house used to be a mortuary, a funeral home back in the day, and that house was where they had the funerals, and the house next door was where the mortician lived, and he had a tunnel underneath the ground that went between them, and he would literally do the embalming in the house where he lived in the basement and roll it into the tunnel under into the funeral home house and raise it up into the floor, and that's where they would do the viewings. And this guy was a necromancer. And I started to see all the symbols and his wife that had died and just all these things that were going on in that house, and that his I can't remember what they called it, the bottle that he had captured the different souls in, he had buried it in the tunnel. And so I could see where it was. And so I was seeing all these things. I'm like, there's a tunnel that's bricked up, but there's a tunnel and there's a hole in the wall with a hose coming through it into your basement. And then, and I'm telling her what I'm seeing, and she's like, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So that the tunnel had been bricked up. And so I actually went there in person, because she asked me for more help. So I went there in person, and I got to go into the neighbor's house, and the whole room where that guy had done the embalming in had actually been bricked up. And mm-hmm. they could see, you could see into that room through a crack, through like maybe a 2-3 inches crack that you could see, and it would shine a light into that room, and there were still things in there. And you could see the doorway that went into the tunnel. But it had been completely bricked up. And I said, I looked for a door down there. And I said, I can't even see where the door used to be. But the windows that were there were bricked up. And I was like, where is the door? There has to be a door somewhere. And then I saw there was a door in the floor upstairs. And I'm like, it was one of those doors that you lift up the floor and you walk down. And they had covered that all up and sealed it up. So yeah,
wow.
Pretty cool stuff.
That is really something, Jen. That is really something.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, so that's the kind of thing I was doing before Bigfoot. So then I thought I can probably use that and, like, scan areas and look for Bigfoot. And so the very first time I was doing that and was looking for a spot to go to and was like, okay, we're going to look here because there have been some sightings back there, and I think they're back there. So I started, like, looking at this whole wooded area. And I'm asking, is there any Bigfoot here? Is there any Bigfoot here? And all of a sudden I see this face of a male Bigfoot. He looked aggressive. I was kind of scared of him, which I didn't naturally feel scared of Bigfoot. I didn't really feel that they were scary because if they were scary, there'd be a lot of people getting killed by them. They obviously don't want to hurt us, or they would be. So killer male that I was seeing felt to me like I was scared of him. He was an aggressive male. And I could see the boundaries of his territory. But then about 200 feet away from that, there was this whole area that was lighting up as Bigfoot evidence that we could collect. And right between that was this little pathway. And I'm looking at it going, can I drive on that? Is that a drivable trail or is that not a drivable trail? Because you can't tell. It's not a marked road. And back there, there's all these little pathways that the local Indians had carved into the woods to go drive their cars around back there to collect downed trees for their firewood. So we didn't know if we could drive on that road or not, if that was something we could drive on or not. And when we got there, sure enough, we drove on it. I scratched the crap out of my car. For you guys who are my Facebook friends, I just recently posted a video on my personal Facebook page about the woods calling us back. It's me driving on that trail and you're videoing the front from the front window of the car, and you can see the tree just scraping up over my car. It'll make you cringe, that's for sure. But we drove back there, and you know, somebody else was driving, and I was I had my Google Maps open, and so I'm watching us on this little trail driving as the blue dot, and I'm waiting for us to get to the right spot between these two locations. And I said, okay, stop the car, stop, stop, stop. And so we stopped, and I'm like, okay, we are right between the two. If we get out of the car and we go right, about 100 feet, we'll hit the edge of that male, that aggressive male's territory. If we get out of the car and go directly left, Bigfoot evidence that we can collect, and it's a really big area that's lighting up. I could have probably asked more questions about that, but I was so focused during my remote view, but I was so focused on that aggressive male that my eye just kept going to him. So we get out of the car, and Jenna wasn't ready to go, and my whole strategy was remote view it, get out of the car quick and go directly to it before they can realize that you're coming. Because I think most of the time when people stumble upon them, they're not expecting to see anything, so they don't, you know, there's plenty of time to hide or whatever. But if we're getting there with purpose and jumping out of the car and just walking straight to them, you know, I think it's the
element. You're
going to
catch them unaware. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, where they maybe not be able to hide all the way. So we get out of the car, you know, I tell them this is what we're going to find, and it was the first time I'd done this specific choosing of a spot like that. And I didn't realize until we got there and were about to execute my plan that Jenna didn't really believe in remote viewing. Because she's la-di-dying. She's talking to Nikki, and Nikki was the one who was driving that day, and she wasn't feeling well. It was really hot, and so she was going to stay in the car. And she's like, oh, Nikki, do you want to use my Netflix on my phone? You know, and I'm like, stop it. Let's go. And she's like, I just want to help you. I said, no, let's go. When I first got out of the car, I was letting Jenna grab her things. And I'm looking out to the right. And I'm looking to see, do I see anything over there? And I took a couple steps, and all of a sudden a rock comes down. And I'm like, And I'm like, yeah, this is probably not smart walking towards the aggressive male. I didn't want to do that. And Nikki says, I think I see something over there. And she was looking to the left. And I'm like, duh, Jen, what are you thinking? Don't be messing with the aggressive male. Go to where the Bigfoot evidence is. So I walk around to the other side of the car, and I start looking into the woods that way. And I'm seeing things scattering back there. And I'm like, oh, there's stuff moving back there. Let's go, let's go. And Jenna's like, oh, da, da, da. I'm like, no, Jenna, no. And I mean, I really got mean at her. I was not very nice because I started walking towards it by myself, and I was thinking to myself, oh, crap. In my head, I didn't say, oh, crap. I used the SH word. Now I'm walking back there by myself. I didn't want to walk back there by myself. I'm like, come on, Jenna, come on, come on, come on, come on. And I still was trying to go ahead with my plan. And finally she catches up, and she's kind of perturbed at me for getting on her like the way that I did. And all of a sudden she looks up and she sees what I'm seeing. And that's a huge structure that we found in the woods. And that edge of it, or that angle of it, was this tower that was 2-3 stories tall, and they were trees that were pulled out of the ground and teepeed together. And then there was foliage that was, like, weaved in between them into, like, levels. And, like, somebody could climb up in there and, like, look out, be a lookout. And, you know, and when we got closer to it, the foliage on the ground moved, like a really big move. And I'm like, oh, there's something in there, because in that tower part, it was completely dark, about 5 feet and down. It was completely dark and open in there, and you couldn't see into it at all. And I'm like, oh, I think something's in there. And so I was a little cautious to get too close to that. And so I'm trying to get around the structure without getting really close to that. I suspected that there was something in there, and I didn't want to corner something, or, I want to be respectful, but yet I still want to see what's here. And so I've got my eye on that dark part, and we're moving sticks to get around to the other side of it. And I didn't realize it until later that the sticks that we were moving were actually put into the ground like a weaved fence. And I didn't realize that until later, because we were so busy looking at this tower. And so we get around to the other side of it, and we see that that tower was like the end cap of an aisle at Walmart. It was about that wide, but it was this structure that was this long rectangular thing that went really far back. It wasn't as tall behind it. It was a completely another structure built on the back. It was really long and rectangular. And these trees had been stacked on top of each other, and then the little branches were weaved together. And nothing was tied, nothing was nailed or screwed. Everything was weaved very tightly together. And it had a back wall, it had a front wall, and a doorway, and it had a roof. And I was just like, holy cow. And there was a doorway. And Jenna's like, you want me to go in there? And I'm like, what? And I'm like, peeked my head into it, and I could see inside there. There wasn't anything in that part, which was separate from the tower part. I'm like, well, I suppose if you want to. I mean, I was like, you want to go in there? It was beyond me that she wanted to go in there. And she's like, yeah. So she climbs in there, and she's looking around, and she was like, wow, the ground is so soft in here. There's no rocks. There's no twigs. And it's like everything had been worked up in the ground. And she's like, this is softer than my mattress. And she's like, I can't believe how soft this is. And I didn't know that until later. I showed it to my neighbor in my office building, who was in the military and did military survival. And he said, Jen, in Minnesota, you can't sleep right on the ground. You'll get hypothermia in the cooler months. The ground will suck the body heat right out of you. You have to dig up the dirt about 8 inches down. You have to dig up the dirt and move it around so that it's not hard ground. It doesn't pull the warmth right out of your body. So then you can lay on the ground and be okay in the cooler months. I'm like, really? I had no idea. So that was really cool to find that out. And so then we had seen, even outside of that, there were little trees that had been pulled out of the ground and then pushed back into the ground, stabbed back into the ground into clusters. So, like, if you had walked, like, 30 feet away from that, you wouldn't have seen it. It was, like, it was being camouflaged, so to speak. Like, you couldn't see that structure was there. All you would see was these little trees. and they were little ash trees, so they were white birch looking trees, and it was just bizarre. And the more I looked around, the bigger I saw that this thing was. And I said, okay, Jenna, I want to see if I can get far enough away to get all of it into one shot. So I'm going to, you stay here, stand right here next to it, in front of it, and I'm going to go over there and see if I can get it all in one shot. And you can be our measurement because you're standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to walk away from her to get farther away, and all of a sudden some rocks came down. And I was like, now there's a lot more foliage on the ground than there. And I'm like, is that a rock? And then pretty soon, you know, I just stopped, and I'm like, is that a rock? And pretty soon another one came, like, yes, that was a rock. Okay, what should I do? And so I thought, okay, I won't walk that way, but maybe I can walk this way. And so I went all the way around that whole patch of trees, and that seemed to be okay. And so I walked around and got further away, and then I was far enough away where I could take a better big shot. And Jenna had a GoPro camera on her forehead, which was blinking this red light. And so, and it was starting to get dark. In the woods, you lose light faster than you do outside of the woods. You know, when the sun starts to go down, it's getting darker a lot faster in the woods than it is outside of the woods. And so I'm like, gosh, it's getting dark so fast. And, you know, I'm seeing this red light blinking on her forehead, so I'm trying to get this whole shot. And so I got some of that, and then I all of a sudden felt scared. And, like, overwhelming scared. And I felt like we've overstayed our welcome. We need to go right now. Right now. And I told Jenna, because
okay.
I knew that we were both parallel to the trail that we had drove in on. Like, we were both parallel to, we were equal distance away from it. I said, Jenna, we need to go right now. Go back to the car, go to the trail. And I headed from, rather than walking back to her, because I knew that they were between her and I. They were between us. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to head through this way and hit the trail there, and you go that way and hit the trail. And she's like, okay. I start going to hit the trail, and I'm saying, this is not the path of least resistance. An animal would never walk this way. You know, and I was breaking sticks and moving things and trying to get through, and I'm just hightailing it out of there. And I couldn't get out of there fast. I just really felt like we have overstayed our welcome. We need to go right now. And as I'm doing this and busting through these sticks, I realized this is just like those sticks that were over there, and they've been placed here. This is a fence. And then I realized how big this whole area is, and that scared me even more. I'm like, how many are back here? There's got to be a lot of them back here. This is like a village. And, yeah, so we made it back to the trail and back to the car, and then it was like this huge adrenaline rush. I couldn't wait to look at the video that we caught. And it was just an awesome experience. It really, really was.
What an encounter.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a question
for
you.
We did go back. What's that?
I say a question for you. Since, you know, you said you've been doing this, like, what is it, 7 years now? I know you did energy work and that type of thing. Have you noticed that throughout that 7 years, not only have your abilities really increased, but you're seeing other type of cryptids as well while you're out?
I've seen little people out there, different kinds. But Jenna and I have both seen them. You know, from my tribe, I know a little bit about the little people, especially the ones that were on our reservation. There's different ones in different locations. And, you know, we haven't had any issues with any of them. You know, I was always taught to be very respectful and thankful to them and give them offerings. But definitely we've seen them. I don't know if you would want to call them cryptids or not. But
no,
I think
but,
they're definitely
yeah, but
real.
they're other entities, yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We did see in one of the videos that I took in the back, I was sharing it with somebody who was interested to see, and he happened to be a MUFON investigator from North Dakota, and he saw what I was kind of seeing in the background. There was something back there that looked like, it looked like a ship that had landed back there. It was very silvery, and when I went back there and looked again, there was nothing like that out there. There was nothing like that out there that could have made that in the video. So, I mean, very interesting. And the tribe talks about, you know, some of the elders in the tribe will talk about the sky people coming mm-hmm. down and talking with them. You know, and that's a very serious thing for them. And, of course, they don't tell you a whole lot about that other than they do have visits from the sky people and they go talk with them. So I don't know what their connection is to that area either. You know, it was very interesting anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. So we did go back to that spot a few times. And when it was getting closer to winter, they took part of it down. Like some of it was laying down, and it was like not in a way that it would fall down. It was laying the completely wrong way if it had just fallen down. And so it looked like they had disassembled part of it for the winter because there was a drivable trail right there. And I suppose without the foliage on all the trees, it would be easily seen if they didn't take some of it down.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked like they disassembled part of it for the winter, and I would love to go back and see if it's back up again. I've talked to different Native people out there that have reported finding such, like, there's structures like that all over the place, and some of them have holes dug into the ground inside of them, so there's like a tunnel that goes down into a cave that they've dug out, like a den. And one of the natives, he was my elder's nephew. Him and his wife are elders now. And he came to have breakfast with me one time when I was working up there for the tribe. And he's like, Jen, I hear you're looking for Bigfoot. And I said, yeah, I sure am. Do you have anything to share with me? Any traditional stuff? I'm always looking for those traditional stories too. And he's like, well, do you know where I live? And I said, well, I kind of know where you live, yeah. And he's like, well, you know, our granddaughters live with us. I'm like, yes, I knew that. And he said, well, they go out playing in the woods quite often behind our house. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, they came home one day and said they found this really cool fort. And as they described this fort, he was like, I want to see this. Take me out there and show it to me. And he said that they took him out there, they walked out there, and something had pulled two big trees out of the ground and teepeed them together with the roof up in the air. And then he says, you, like, walk underneath that, and you keep going, and then there's this hogan-looking structure. And I said, what is a hogan structure? He said, well, it looks like a wigwam, but it's more square. More rectangular shaped, and he says the trees were like stacked and made together, and I'm like, okay, yeah, cool. And he's like, there's a doorway but no door. I'm like, yep. And then he says he went inside and there was this tunnel down in there that goes under the ground, and when his granddaughters found it, they went down in there. And that scared the crap out of him when he looked down into that hole knowing that his granddaughters had gone down in there. And he's like, you know, we know what had to have made this. You know, it had to have been a Bigfoot. But even if that Bigfoot doesn't live there anymore, a bear or something big could have moved into that. And, you know, we could have lost our girls from mm-hmm. going down in there. You know, and so they're very traditional Native people. And they teach the children out there that they're never alone when they're in the woods because they're surrounded by all their relatives, the trees, the grass, the plants, everything is their relative. And so you have this sense of being surrounded by all this love and care. But for him to start teaching his granddaughters not to go near anything like that ever again and to be afraid of it,
big,
that was a completely different thing.
Big change.
Yeah, it was a big change. Big change. Big change. But he was afraid. He said, we could have lost our girls. We could have lost our granddaughters that day. So the DNR up there, the tribal DNR, I've talked to them, and they said they sometimes run into those kinds of structures, and they, as soon as they spot them, they back away. Immediately, they back away. They don't bother it at all. They said, we know what's making those, and we don't want anything to do with it. So, yeah, they have a lot of respect for Bigfoot up there.
That is wonderful. And, Jen, I'll tell you what. It has been wonderful having you here with us on ScaryCast as we have.
Yeah, definitely, Jen. I love having you.
I'm excited to see you next month.
I know. That'll be fun.
yeah.
That's right, because you two are going to be at a conference together.
Yes, in Nebraska.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I hope that the two of you have a wonderful time, number one. Number two, we've got a lot of great new guests coming on. And Jen, can we get you back in about 2 months to talk more? Because you're so interesting, and we'd love to have you. Can you come back in about 2 months?
Sure.
Well, thank you so very much. We would really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you, Jen. It's always great when you're here.
This is tremendous, Jen. Robin has told me some information I had no idea about, and a lot of what you said is right in the parallel track with what Robin has communicated. So it's just fascinating to learn more and more about this.
That's awesome. Well, if it's true, it's always true.
You can't change the truth, huh?
Right? Exactly.
If it's true, it's always true. That's a great phrase for you to say, and we really appreciate it. So I'll tell you what, as we grow into our new ScaryCast show, next week we've got Matt Perry from the Vulnerability Podcast. The next week, I want to ask Devin Tate, are you still with us tonight?
I sure am, of course.
Hey, Devin.
I would like to have you talk about that wonderful, wonderful documentary that you did with Lizard Man, which will coincide with the release of the new Lizard Man book, Lizard Man Companion. In 2 weeks, can you go from being a co-host to being a guest, and can you join us to talk about your wonderful the thing that you did for the Lizard Man Festival last year? Can you join us for that, and we'll have online so that people can see?
Yeah, of course, I would love to. I'd be very happy to do that. Just one note, I won't be able to join you on April 12th because I'm having a dental surgery, and I probably will not be able to talk at that point. But as long as we can schedule around that.
Yeah. Okay, well, we can certainly do that, and that would be wonderful to have you to talk about this and with my brand-new book. And it's going to be just a lot of fun. So we've got a lot of great things coming on with ScaryCast. And I want to thank our co-hosts, Dr. Trey Donaway, Robin McCray, the amazing Velvet, and of course, Devin, because we've had a great time with all of you guys for years. And of course, I want to thank so much Robin McCray for all of her commentary, especially
you want to thank Jen.
Jen, thank you very much. You know, and I've got to go ahead and tell everybody this. I had a stroke about 4 weeks ago, and sometimes I can be talking and I can completely forget everything. So, Robin McCray, thank you very much. Jen, we really appreciate you being on our show tonight. We'll have you in a couple of months, and thank you so much. And we're here on WLSC-FM
and AM. And thanks a lot for everyone being here.
And FM.
We'll see you.
Yeah, thank you guys for everything. I'm so glad to talk to everybody tonight. Jen, it's wonderful. I can't wait to see you next month.
I know. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, everybody.
All right.
Everybody take care.
All right. We'll see everybody next week with our guest, Matt Perry, from the wonderful Vulnerability Podcast. And thanks, everybody, and we will see you next week on WLSC AM and FM.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Night. Great guest. Yes. Great story. Great information.